A homecoming of sorts for a former Texas law professor now running for president. Our conversation with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. As Texas barrels toward Super Tuesday, Democratic presidential candidates are scouring the state for delegates. We'll hear how Elizabeth Warren says she plans to deal with some of the top issues facing Texas. Also, another sort of battleground in the Lone Star State as parties scramble to get newcomers registered. Plus, the week in Texas politics and a whole lot more. No matter where you are, it's almost Texas Standard time, and we'll get underway right after this. No matter where you are, you voted, right? Yes, it's Texas Standard time on this Friday, February 28th. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Early voting in the Texas primaries ends tonight, which means if you miss out, you'll have to wait till the day of Super Tuesday, March 3rd, before casting your ballot. Texas is an open primary state, one of 17 nationwide. So no matter if deep down you're a Democrat or a Republican, you can choose from year to year which primary you want to cast a ballot in. You just show up to your polling location and let them know. Of course, you're stuck in that lane through any runoffs, but that's the way the game is played. Now, if you're running for president, the rules of the game appear to have changed somewhat here in Texas. Used to be Democratic contenders didn't spend a whole lot of time here, since the conventional wisdom was that it's too red to make retail campaigning that much worthwhile for them. But have you noticed how many Democrats are running ads here? Picked up on the big names swinging through Texas, staging rallies, upping their ground game? Massachusetts Senator and one-time Texas law professor Elizabeth Warren is one of them. Since we've been trying to talk to all of the candidates in the presidential race, we couldn't pass up this chance to get her on the record about some issues near and dear to the minds of Texas voters. Senator Elizabeth Warren, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. It's good to be back in Texas.
I was going to say, this is a bit of a homecoming. I know a few decades back you spent some time in Texas, professor, and if we have a couple of minutes here at the end, I want to loop back to that, but there are some substantive questions we've been putting to all the candidates we've had a chance to talk to so far. Among those issues, Texas, of course, at the center of the debate over immigration and border security. You've just unveiled what you call a border communities plan. What does that involve?
Well, it involves strengthening our border communities and recognizing that these are communities that have existed for a long time and had people who are working on both sides of the border and who need to be acknowledged as such. It's the reminder that immigration does not make our country weaker, it makes our country stronger, and that we need a border plan that is not about someone standing on one side of the border shooting across at someone else. Border communities reflect the best in America, but too often politicians in Washington degrade them and divide them for political gain. So I've got a plan to stop Donald Trump's militarization of the border, to stop his racist wall, and to fight for safe, prosperous border communities. For me, that's what this is all about.
But, Senator, the issue of immigration has been going on for some time, and Congress hasn't yet acted. And, of course, the president and others, this is a bipartisan concern, They're concerned that unless Congress actually takes affirmative steps, that there won't be any real substantive change on the border. What would you do to make things different? Or would you, of course, the Republicans would like to frame this as the Democrats want to throw open the gates, right?
Well, look, my commitment to immigration reform in my first term is rock solid. But you've got to remember, this is about digging in and doing the hard work to get something done. I've been in the Senate now for a full term. I've been there when immigration reform comes up and the filibuster gives a veto to people who don't want to make change. We need to get rid of the filibuster if Mitch McConnell is going to block any change. We need to be willing to stand up and fight for an America that is stronger, and that means for an immigration plan that works. We need to expand legal immigration. We need a pathway to citizenship. for the people who are here, and we need to stop the crisis down at our borders.
Expanding legal immigration. Of course, you refer to Mitch McConnell. You're talking about the Senate Majority Leader. I want to move on to another issue here. Texans have been faced with several mass shootings in the recent months. Just last year, there were two within weeks of each other in El Paso and Midland, Odessa. You've said you have a goal of reducing gun deaths by 80%, but of course, how do you sell Texans on gun control?
So, once again, look at who government works for. More than 90% of Americans want to see just some basic steps on gun safety in this country. Uniform background checks, getting weapons of war off our streets. And yet, we can't even get a vote in the United States Senate. Why not? Because who's really calling the shots there? It's the NRA and the gun industry. Look, I believe in democracy, and in a democracy, when the majority of people want to see us vote on something and get something done, that's what we ought to be doing. And gun violence is something that's about mass shootings, and I know how people have suffered here in Texas. We have to remember it's also about the shootings that occur every day on sidewalks and playgrounds, particularly that hit communities of color, but never, ever raise a headline. It's also about the lethality of suicides, and it's about the increased likelihood of domestic violence ending in a death if a woman, it's usually a woman, is in a home where there is both an abuser and a gun. Look, we need to treat this as a gun violence problem. There's not going to be a single bill or a single answer. It's a public health emergency. We need to take the steps that are clear and in front of us. We need to keep studying it, and we're going to need to go back again and again until we reduce those deaths. We owe it to our children. We owe it to our brothers and sisters.
Senator,
we need to bring down the death rate.
Are you saying that you would declare a health care emergency over gun violence if you were elected president?
No. I'm saying it is a public health issue, and that's how we have to approach it. It puts our children at risk. It puts our neighbors at risk. There are many, many steps we can take. This is not going to be a one and done. There are some steps that are pretty obvious that we should take now about registration and background checks and getting rid of weapons of war. But for example, the numbers seem to show that just putting a waiting period in place of a few days cuts down death by gun, by suicide, because people who are given a little more time to think about it and to reach out and get help. That, you know, those are the kinds of things we need to study to make this better.
Forgive me for interrupting you, but I want to make sure that we get to the issue of health care, which I know is close to you. Texas, as you're aware, is home to the largest number of uninsured people in the country. Early on in the campaign, you said you supported Medicare for All, but then in November, you released a plan that called for transitioning to Medicare for All. And I'm curious, why the switch, and how do you see the transition from the current Affordable Care Act to this Medicare for All?
Look, the way I see it, I'll just give you one example. 36 million Americans could not afford to have a prescription filled last year. Think about what that means. 36 million people were sick enough or worried enough to make an appointment, go to the doctor. The doctor looked at it and said, that's a real problem, wrote a prescription, and then the person looked at that prescription and said, it's that or buy groceries. It's that or pay the rent on time. So I approach this as saying we need the most help to the most people as quickly as possible. On day one as president, I will support the Affordable Care Act from the sabotage of the Trump administration, and I will use the power that the president already has to bring down the cost of prescription drugs, drugs like insulin and EpiPens and HIV AIDS drugs and mental health drugs. We can bring down those costs and save Americans hundreds of millions of dollars. I've also shown how we can get universal health care coverage without raising taxes on middle-class families by one thin dime. And that will permit us in the first 100 days to be able to offer full health care coverage for people who want it, For people under 18, they can have it for free. For people whose incomes are below $50,000, they can have it for free. For others, for a modest cost. Let people try full health care coverage, see how they like it, and then we'll vote on Medicare for All. And I think people are going to vote to say this is a good system and we like it. But at each point along the way, we're making the system better. Better for the people who need health care coverage across Texas and across this country.
I want to ask you one final thing, and this has to do with a former fellow presidential candidate, a certain HUD secretary and Texan who's been a strong supporter of yours since he dropped out of the race. Senator, if you do become the nominee, what do you think about Julian Castro as a running mate?
Oh, I think Julian is terrific. Now, look, it would be presumptuous of me to be talking about a vice president at this point, but I got to tell you, I've known Julian for many, many years and worked with him when he was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and worked with him after that. Integrated many of the plans from his presidency into mine. I was deeply honored when he endorsed me and didn't just endorse and sit back, really got into the fight, because Julian and I share a vision of an America that doesn't just work for rich people, but an America that builds real opportunity, real chances for prosperity, not just for some of our kids, but for all of our kids. That's why we're in this fight, and I'm loving fighting it with my partner, Julian Castro.
Senator Warren, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard, and enjoy your time in Texas.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I'm having fun.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat hoping to challenge Donald Trump in November and win Texas delegates on Super Tuesday, speaking with us just before a campaign event in San Antonio on Thursday. You can hear more of our conversations with presidential candidates at texasstandard.org. So she wouldn't go quite so far as to announce that she'd make Julian Castro her running mate.
Yeah,
but there we are.
There's always next time.
So Wells Dunbar, social media editor, what are you hearing from across the Lone Star State?
Well, David, we're hearing from our friends and listeners about Elizabeth Warren and many of her calls for big structural change, capturing our friends and listeners' imaginations. On our Facebook page, Jeremy Kripe says, I like her proposal to have workers vote on their members of the board of directors for their company, similar to co-determination in Germany. It's about time U.S. employees have widespread workplace representation. However, Jordan Peterson isn't as sure. He says most people just pick up their paycheck and leave. Yet Ihor Gowda says Warren has earned their vote on Super Tuesday, calling her the best choice. Lots more opinions out there today, David. Also hearing about some other news out there, Houston's recovery from that massive water main leak that flooded portions of Interstate 610, the inner loop. Yeah, it really looked like a natural, like an act of God, if you will.
Yeah.
That crazy flooding. So, getting reactions about that and some other stories coming in. I'll be back with those reactions later in the show.
And, of course, we'd love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. And Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He's going to be back in about 35 minutes or so with more of the Talk of Texas. Hey there, it's Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For the first time in years, Texas Republicans are making big investments in registering GOP voters. This comes as Texas is changing with more Latino voters who may be energized by President Trump's immigration policies. What this all means, as Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval reports, is a different sort of political battleground emerging in Texas.
Texas Republicans have swept statewide races for decades. So when Beto O'Rourke lost his bid for Senate against Ted Cruz by a margin of 2.6 percentage points in 2018, it was a wake-up call for Republicans, says Texas GOP Chairman James Dickey.
We started right away in December 2018 pushing the idea that for the first time in anyone's memory, the party, the Republican Party of Texas, needed to be intentional about doing voter registration efforts.
Dickey says they've registered almost 50,000 new voters who are likely to support Republicans. He also points to the new Republican super PAC Engage Texas as evidence of just how important registration is to the party.
But we were looking for every stone to turn over to get conservative voters from all walks of life and all ages and ethnicities.
Ray Sullivan is spokesman for Engage Texas. The group has raised nearly $12 million since it began in summer 2019, according to the most recent FEC filings.
We've registered well over 100,000 Texas voters.
Sullivan says they have 300 canvassers on the ground who ask voters about their views on immigration, abortion, and guns. Then they ask if they're registered to vote. They go to community events, county fairs, church events, and...
We find that Trump rallies are a particularly good place to identify conservative voters and some folks that are not registered.
This is happening against a backdrop of a nonpartisan push to register Latinos, efforts that are likely to benefit Democrats, especially in years to come. There's evidence that shows a boost in Latino registration and turnout contributed to Beto O'Rourke's close finish against Ted Cruz. Around half of the Texas population under 18 is Hispanic.
Si ya están registrados para votar, le podemos dar eso que puede rellenar para nosotros.
At a quinceañera in the Houston area, canvasser Crystal Alonso stands next to a photo booth and asks a couple if they're registered to vote.
And I usually go to high schools, college campuses, or to quinceañeras, and also farmers markets, you know.
But these creative efforts come as Democrats face several challenges in registering voters, says Rice University political scientist Bob Stein.
For Democrats, there is a much larger share of their base that's not registered because they're younger, non-Anglo, lower socioeconomic status, and they move around a lot.
And the state hasn't exactly made it easy to register voters to begin with, Stein says.
We don't have same day or election day registration. We don't allow any type of online registration.
Republicans are also trying to find new Latino voters who will back the GOP. Ray Sullivan with the GOP group Engage Texas says they've hired bilingual canvassers to reach Spanish-speaking eligible voters.
Respect for the Second Amendment, for border security, respect for life are issues that resonate strongly with Hispanic Texans, and we want to make sure that those folks are identified and registered.
Texas Republicans aren't looking to win over all Latinos. They've netted a third of the statewide Latino vote for more than a decade. But that may be all they need to win in 2020. I'm Elizabeth Trofall in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Today is the last day Texas voters can cast their ballots early ahead of Super Tuesday, as we were saying earlier. As you probably know, you've got to be 18 to vote, right? Which means what exactly for those who will be 18 come November, but who haven't quite reached that magic number by March 3rd? Well, Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony reports on a push to give some 17-year-olds a primary right.
Kelsey Tash is a senior at McCallum High School in Austin. She's also on the advisory council of Own Our Vote, which aims to increase voter registration and turnout among young people.
It kind of feels like at this point, political activism and exerting our voice seems more crucial now than it ever has been before.
But she won't be able to exert her voice on Super Tuesday because she doesn't turn 18 until July. In Texas, an estimated 280,000 17-year-olds will turn 18 in time for the general election, but are currently too young to take part in the primary. Some say that unfairly excludes them from a crucial step in the election. Tash says she and her friends talk about policy issues all the time.
And so it's hard to see all of these candidates and to have opinions and feelings, but not get to exercise my opinion.
About 24 other states allow 17-year-olds to have some form of participation in primaries and caucuses. For the first time this year, Colorado is allowing those young people to vote in primaries. One state legislator has tried, repeatedly, to get Texas to adopt a similar rule.
Beginning in 2015, 2017, and 2019, we actually had committee hearings, the first two go-arounds, but did not even get a committee hearing this time around.
Texas House member Donna Howard represents State District 48 in Austin. She says her efforts to expand voting rights are not partisan.
Lots of not only bipartisan support from legislators here at the Capitol, but also from young people representing the young Republicans and the young Democrats.
Despite support on both sides of the aisle, Howard never got her bill passed. James Slattery, a senior staff attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project, says the lack of movement on this bill fits in with the state government's history on voting rights.
I think it is of a piece with, unfortunately, how this how state leadership here treats voting rights, which is it's either not a priority or the priority is to silence people's voices.
Howard says she's heard from some that 17-year-olds aren't mature enough to vote, but she doesn't buy that.
Well, you know what? There's a lot of 17-year-olds who are out there working, some of them even supporting themselves and their families. They can actually join the military. They can actually sign up when they're 17. And I just find it ludicrous to think that they're not mature enough.
As part of his work for the Texas Civil Rights Project, James Slattery ensures that public high schools are obeying state law by offering their seniors the opportunity to register to vote. Through that work, he's met teenage students who, he says, are more civically engaged than some adults. He says he met one group of high school students who formed their own 501c3 with the purpose of increasing voter registration.
That's not only light years ahead of what my generation was doing at their age, but honestly, I'm not even sure that I knew what a 501c3 or 501c4 was until I was, you know, a decade older than them.
For Tash, who will graduate high school this spring, the upcoming general election elicits mixed feelings.
So, like, now that we're actually coming up on the 2020 elections, it's both exciting and antagonizing in a way.
Antagonizing because Tash and hundreds of thousands of other voters have less of a say than their peers who are only a few months older than them. I'm Dominic Anthony in San Antonio.
Hey, think you're smart? Smarter than a robot? University of North Texas is launching a new program to meet what it calls the booming demand for artificial intelligence professionals. UNT is about to offer the only Master of Science degree in AI in all of Texas. The university says its PhD students are already applying AI, from building autonomous cars to applied medicine. The idea here is to give students an edge in competing for jobs in the future workforce. Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Governor Greg Abbott says Texas agencies are taking a number of steps to prepare for the possible spread of the coronavirus to the state. Abbott said Thursday he spoke with Vice President Mike Pence about federal funding for prevention efforts.
We don't know yet how much may be allocated for the states. The Vice President made it sound like they were very committed to assisting the states in any way possible.
Congressional leaders say they're close to reaching a bipartisan plan to release funding to combat COVID-19. The city of Houston is dealing with the aftermath of Thursday's massive water main break, which caused significant disruptions. As Houston Public Media's Laurie Johnson reports, the disaster flooded a freeway and shut down businesses, courts, and schools.
Officials described the 96-inch water main as a pipe the size of a bus. The first public sign of the break came when water rushed across a freeway so quickly that drivers were left stranded. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner said multiple people had to be rescued.
The water was coming out at a rapid rate, and there were people that were literally on top of their cars, and that's where fire and police got them.
Turner said the line serves 45% to 50% of the city's water system. Officials said the break happened when contractors were on site attempting to fix a leak.
And as of this morning, much of the city remains under a boil water notice. Democratic presidential candidates are ramping up their outreach to Texas voters ahead of Super Tuesday, and that includes advertising. Pete Buttigieg, for example, has a digital ad tailor-made to the state. In it, Selena Garcia from Houston explains why she's supporting the former South Bend, Indiana mayor.
Pete is the best candidate for the Dreamers community because for far too long, I never had a sense of belonging. I was told I don't belong here and I don't belong where I came from. Throughout his campaign and mission, they have given me that sense of belonging regardless of my documentation.
Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has an ad addressing the mass shooting at an El Paso Walmart. It features Democratic State Representative Cesar Blanco, whose district includes the West Texas city.
This is my town, my Walmart, where 22 of my neighbors were killed at gunpoint for just being who we are. In El Paso, strength means standing by your neighbors.
That's what Mike Bloomberg did in Sandy Hook, in Parkland, and in El Paso, taking on the gun lobby.
Also, former Vice President Joe Biden's campaign is announced a six-figure media effort in eight states, including Texas. Early voting for the March 3rd primary ends today. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Fairmont Austin, celebrating Valentine's Day with a special tasting in Garrison, champagne and oysters in review, and an Austin is for Lovers room package. Details at fairmontaustin.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Just a few more days to go until Super Tuesday, when Texas and 13 other states pick candidates for the November ballot. That includes choosing which Democrat will face President Donald Trump. We here at the Texas Standard are taking some time this week to examine what issues might influence what Texans actually do at the polls, especially with a view to any changes between 2016 and 2020. Today, the spotlight's on education. If you go to the website of the Texas State Teachers Association, you'll find a video, Fire Betsy DeVos. That's President Trump's education secretary. The TSTA doesn't shy away from taking a political perspective when it comes to education, but one question is whether and to what degree education is likely to be a factor as Texans go to the polls. Noel Candelaria is the group's president. Mr. Candelaria, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Thinking about what the TSTA was working on in 2016, you fast forward to the conversation today. Has anything changed?
A lot has changed in Texas. I think educators, for one, are a lot more in tune with what's happening nationally with the presidential race. With Betsy DeVos becoming our Secretary of Education, there's a heightened sense of awareness of educators, Republicans and Democrats in Texas, who dislike the Secretary of Education. And so for us, that's been a big focus across the state, and educators across the state that need a Secretary of Education that actually believes in public education.
Well, let's jump right into this, because in his State of the Union, President Trump had some pretty harsh words for public education. At one point, he said, for too long, countless American children have been trapped in failing government schools. And the president's also urging Congress to pass legislation to fund scholarships to private schools, as he made a big show of that during the State of the Union address. You came out against this at the time. What will the voucher school choice debate look like as we move toward November?
But I think it's an issue that Texans have overwhelmingly rejected, which is why we don't have vouchers in Texas. Both Republicans and Democrats value their public schools. Over 90% of our Texas children are educated in our public schools. They support their public schools, so it is an issue.
But I want to ask you about this, because here in the Texas capital city, the public school system has been really concerned about attrition, a loss of a lot of students. This at a time when the city's growing exponentially. So people are making different choices. So my question for you is, how much do people really value schools, and are they not leaning in the direction of school choice? And when I say schools, I'm talking about public schools, of course.
I mean, I think what we're seeing a lot is that folks want something different for their students. And right now, the way our current system is underfunded, you know, what parents are looking for are smaller class sizes, right? They're looking for opportunities for their students that right now, because our schools are so cash strapped across the state of Texas, I mean, even the $6.5 billion that the Texas legislature and House Bill 3 added to public education, we're still behind 2008 funding levels when you take that into account. And so we are still lagging behind the national average when it comes to how we prioritize funding our public schools. You look at the needs that we have right now with mental health and mental issues in our classrooms across the state. There's still great needs. And I think what parents are looking for is, you know, how we can provide the best education for their kids.
Let me ask you how that translates politically here in Texas, because Democrats, for the first time in a long time, believe they might be able to take the Texas House. Would that change the dynamic for teachers?
I think it did. I mean, what you saw in the last election is 12 seats were flipped from Republican to Democrat, I think, which changed the tone in the Texas legislature this last session, that really put public education at the center or forefront of a lot of that happened in this last session. So as we look at Texas flipping and taking the House, I think public education is going to take a much more prominent role.
Now, I'm pretty sure that teachers will be thinking about these issues as they go to the ballots. But what about everyday Texans? How will it rank in terms of importance, do you think?
I mean, for us, I think it's intersectional. I mean, when you look at every issue that impacts all of our students, healthcare, right, guns and safety in our schools, education. For us, these are issues that impact all of the families and of the children that we educate. You know, these issues all interrelate to each other. And as we talk to families and voters, you know, in our communities as educators, that's one thing that is resonating is, you know, the overall health and impact of their children and opportunities they want for their children to be able to live a healthy life, you know, a happy life, and get the education that they deserve, which is what we all want for all of our students across the state. And so the intersectionality of all these issues really happens in our classrooms in our Texas public schools.
We were talking a little bit before we got started here, and I was thinking that perhaps this might be a bit of a downtime for you, considering that the legislature is not in session. You sort of smiled as you are right now. You're a pretty busy man these days.
You know, it's always busy for us because one is we are always, you know, looking and working with our members and our educators across the state on what we continue to do to elevate, you know, the profession and elevate the resources and bring the additional resources that they need in their classrooms. And elections matter. So, I mean, there are so many issues at stake for us with this next election, from the school board level all the way to the White House.
Noel Candelaria is president of the Texas State Teachers Association. Mr. Candelaria, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having us talk about our priorities. Appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where horned frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
Hi, my name is Lila Lee, and I'm the author of the Mindy Kim series. Since I was always a new kid, I didn't have many friends or books for my friends. So books meant a lot to me growing up. And that's why, as a writer, I want to focus on children's books, because I know how important books can be in kids' lives. Mindy is a second grader. She's 7.5 years old. Half is very important. And she loves dogs, and she's very friendly. In the beginning of the book, she moves because her mother recently passed away from a long-term illness. And so in the beginning of the book, it's kind of really sad because it's her and her dad adjusting to their new life in Florida in this new house. But despite the sadness, she always tries to see the good in things. And one of her goals is actually to make her dad happy. And she thinks that she can do that by buying him a puppy. I was born in Korea, and I moved to the United States when I was 5. I moved to California, and then moved to Florida and Texas. And growing up, I'm fortunate enough to live in some neighborhoods where there are a lot of like diverse populations, but it was a mostly white community. And I just felt very out of place because at school, I'd bring snacks, like Korean snacks, and they'd be like, what is that? And I also got bullied in the playground a bit for being Asian. So Mindy moves from California to Florida. What's interesting is that, well, in California, she's in a neighborhood where there's a lot of girls who look like her, a lot of Asian people. But in Florida, there isn't that many kids that look like her. And because of that, she basically feels very lonely and like out of place. And that's actually based on my real childhood experience. So I wanted to write a book that reflected on that. And Mindy also, like in the beginning of the book, she brings her Korean food to lunch. And she gets the whole like, what is that? Why are you eating seaweed? And my book is kind of like a fun twist in that she basically takes advantage of the fact that these kids don't know what a seaweed is, and she thinks it's a cool opportunity to trade her seaweed snacks for other kids' snacks, and that's how she makes friends. When I was growing up, I loved the Magic Treehouse books, and I loved Junie B. Jones, also like the Edge Chronicles, Artemis Fowl, I can go on and on. So all these books had one commonality, and that they were about white kids. So that's why for me as an author, it was really important for me to write about kids who looked like me, so that kids today had a representation in literature that I didn't get to see when I was growing up. I dedicated the first book to all the new kids out there, and I said, you're not alone, because I feel like that would have meant a lot to me when I was a kid and I was moving around so much. Hi, my name is Lila Lee. I'm the author of the Mindy Kim series, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
During Black History Month, schools often fold in lessons and events focusing on African Americans, but as some have noted, there may be something detrimental in pigeonholing Black history into a single month-long observance. KERA's Galilee Abdullah visited the Solar Preparatory School for Girls in Dallas, where two teachers are making sure Black history isn't relegated to a once-a-year focus.
In Nicolette Jones's kindergarten classroom, some students are watching a video about astronaut Mae Jemison, the first Black woman to journey to space. Others are sitting on the carpet and reading books featuring Black characters. One book's called Nappy Hair, about a girl who learns to love her hair. Jones says it's important to have these types of books in her classroom and not just during Black History Month.
I can get them seeing themselves in what they're reading on an everyday basis, then they'll eventually start to believe themselves. And then I want to make sure that it's well-rounded because I want them to realize that everybody is valuable, not just one or the other.
Jones encourages her students to ask questions about anything, things they don't understand, and that often touches on race. She recalls a time when a student asked her why there isn't a White History Month.
We actually talked about why that's not the case, because every day is white history, you know, when you learn about history.
That led to a bigger conversation about segregation and race.
You know, the water fountains versus where you were able to sit on the bus, where you could go, where you couldn't go. And then that even went further to talking about the money that we're able to make and homelessness.
Deep stuff for kindergartners. But Jones says they're mature enough to discuss and process this history. She wants her students to celebrate Black History Month, but she also wants to give them space to celebrate themselves. So when her students come to class, they start their day focused on building self-esteem, something called Shine Time.
When we come to Shine Time, I have affirmations that talk about loving yourself exactly as you are, or you being enough, you know, and we have like a specific greeting that we do where the girls go around the circle saying, I love myself. I mean, every single thing from the color of my skin to my soul within.
And upstairs at Solar Prep, the fourth graders in Rochelle Haley's class are much quieter, drawing and writing reflections on what they've learned during Black History Month.
Being an African-American teacher, I want to make sure that they understand that celebrating the history of anybody only during their month is just a celebration. But really getting to know each other and understanding really who you are, that comes with really being proud of the skin you're in.
Haley says Black History Month is a chance for her fourth graders to talk about everything, including slavery. But she wants them to know that Blackness didn't start with slavery, and that Black history isn't just a lesson on oppression.
I took them to the robotics lab, and we just did like a virtual tour of Africa and then the kingdoms that used to be of Africa, and every group had their own kingdom that they had to present. We had a time where we talked about slavery. With slavery, we really focused on just fierce females. And so who was the abolitionist? Who stood up, and what did it take?
Beyond the lessons, Haley wants her students to feel comfortable talking about what's happening today. She wants them to have a voice and discuss the injustices they see inside and outside of school.
More Black girls are sent to prison. More Black girls are taken from their parents. More Black girls are going into the streets and just living in the streets because they feel like there are no options because people don't value them. Have you ever felt as solar like you're not paid attention to or you're not seen? And having those conversations make them a little bit more aware.
One of Haley's students, Olivia Waterhouse, was excited to share what she's learned over the past few weeks.
I got to speak and I got to show my other side of me of reading this paragraph about Black history and how we can change others' seeing of what Black history is to them.
For Charlotte Vesey, her favorite part of the month has been writing a story about Black history that she can share with others.
And I could teach younger girls about Black history, and that just seems like something that's fun and life-changing.
Even after February's over, the lessons about Black history, about Blackness, are forever. I'm Galilee Abdullah in Dallas.
Any of you unlucky enough to make a trip to the DMV this week? Well, maybe you noticed more than your photo changing on your new driver's license. This week, the Texas Department of Public Safety rolled out a new design, many changes being made for security's sake. For example, the new driver's licenses are made out of a polycarbonate material that's tougher to replicate. And your name and driver's license number will be engraved right onto the card. Still got an oldie? Well, it's still a goodie, at least until the expiration date on the front. Then you may have to check in with that DMV. Sorry about that. Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. There's more ahead. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I am Jody Edgerton, and I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. And we are a group that crafts custom poems on vintage typewriters. You give us a word, an idea, a phrase, something you'd like a poem about, and we will write you a poem on the spot. Leap year. Get ready, because this year has a whole extra day. And it is yours, all yours, to live out as you see fit. So take the plunge. Make the wish. There's magic in the air. When a bonus day adorns our year, each dream is ours to share. Maybe you'll make a brand new friend, or buy a chocolate bar, or treat a neighbor to that trumpet solo you've been practicing all winter. Maybe you'll just take a super long nap and wear pajamas all day. Whatever you do, just know you have the magic of the leap day on your side. I'm Jody Edgerton, and you're on Texas Standard Time.
Support for the Typewriter Radio comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes in care and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
You can catch the Typewriter Rodeo each and every Friday right here on the Texas Standard or anytime on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to send us your Typewriter Rodeo requests on social media or shoot us an email. Any of that will work. TexasStandard@KUT.org. Wrapping up the week wouldn't be complete without checking in with Alex Samuels, would it? She's political reporter for the Texas Tribune. Alex, good to speak with you again.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
We got Texas politics in the rearview mirror, and this is the last day of early voting here in the Lone Star State. Those who don't vote today will need to head to the polls on Tuesday. Explain this to us, because I think a lot of people are a little fuzzy on this. You got 228 delegates up for grabs. How do you divvy those up among the Democrats who are all vying to take on President Trump?
Mm-hmm. So of those 228 delegates, 149 are awarded based on the results in each of the 31 state Senate districts. Mm-hmm. And then the remaining 79 are awarded based on the results of the statewide vote. So a candidate must reach 15% in a district to compete for its delegates and 15% statewide to be eligible for its statewide delegates.
So there's a sort of an incentive to do some retail politicking, I guess, knocking on doors and that sort of thing.
Right. That's why we saw last weekend Bernie Sanders hitting all the big cities. But we've seen some other candidates, Elizabeth Warren, Michael Bloomberg, Pete Buttigieg, who have TV ads going up in the more rural parts of the state so they can compete for those delegates, too.
I think it's kind of interesting. Maybe some people who are who've been in Texas for a while probably can't remember the last time Democrats were duking it out right here in the Lone Star State. They come here to get money. But, this kind of politicking for Texas delegates, that's changed. And I wonder why that is.
Yeah, I think one of the main things is that unlike 2008 and 2016, there are a plethora of viable Democratic candidates to choose from. So as you mentioned, Elizabeth Warren was in San Antonio yesterday. Michael Bloomberg was in Houston yesterday. And then throughout the weekend, we're just going to see a bunch of Democratic candidates and their surrogates campaigning in the state ahead of Super Tuesday.
We probably need to shift gears here because there was some big news from Governor Abbott yesterday. He was talking about how the state's preparing for possible spread of that coronavirus. What did he have to say substantively?
Right. So Governor Greg Abbott held, I believe it was just a briefing yesterday with Dan Patrick, House Speaker Dennis Bonin, just saying that health officials are saying that the threat of a Texas outbreak remains low, but that the state is preparing for all possible outcomes. I think what he told the Statesman is that they're preparing for different scenarios ranging from the status quo to an extreme pandemic.
That's quite a range, and I think it leaves a lot of listeners sort of wondering, okay, what does that mean for me? Are officials spelling out anything that we should be doing here in Texas, or was it more sort of a briefing on what the state is doing behind the scenes?
I am more of the mindset that it was a briefing of what the state is doing behind the scenes. From what I've seen, officials are just telling people to, you know, get a flu shot, wash your hands, stay home if you feel sick, you know, basic things that you should be doing.
Yeah, general advice, right? Yeah, yeah. And I guess they're trying to keep down the spread of panic or fear, for sure. We've been speaking with Alex Samuels. She is political reporter for the Texas Tribune, talking about the week that was in Texas politics. Alex, have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. All right. He's back. Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Feeling the Friday?
Oh, I got those Friday feelings, man. You know it.
Indeed.
Well, so, you know.
What are Texans talking about?
Well, I was going to say it may be leap year weekend, but there is no extra day for early voting. It ends today, Friday, February 28th, and many folks making note online. On our Facebook page, Victoria Sada says, your vote is your vote. Your vote is your voice, rather. Be heard, Texans. And Tina Harris says, I'm going today. I hope everybody votes. And speaking of elections, let's return to something I talked about a little bit yesterday. Believe it or not, the unicorn that is the undecided voter does indeed exist.
I don't believe it.
You were a little, you know, you were in disbelief.
Yes.
And I did mention that we had several folks out there chiming in as to why they were undecided. Let's visit some of these reasons. It's pretty interesting stuff here. Nicole LeBlanc, I think she speaks to something that may be a little broader this year than it has in elections past just due to the field of candidates. She says, I am decided if my candidate is still in the race next Tuesday.
Oh.
That's why I have not voted early. I want to vote for Klobuchar, but she is one of several who may reassess after South Carolina. If she suspends before Super Tuesday, I will vote for someone else.
I guess it could happen, right? I mean, someone could decide to bail before Super Tuesday. It doesn't seem like it would be very, I don't know, wise?
Yeah.
I mean, because you're just a couple of days away. Can't you hang in there just that much longer?
Well, and it's this interesting, you know, that returns to another political topic we've talked about this week. Many sort of centrist or rightward Democrats concerned about the momentum of Bernie Sanders building,
right.
But it's this broad field that's really preventing anyone from letting those people that would challenge Sanders coalesce behind one candidate.
Mm.
So maybe, you know, someone, if they perform poorly, if they're really concerned about a Sanders candidacy, maybe they would take one for the team and drop out before Super Tuesday.
We shall see. There's a lot that's going to happen over the next
it's going to be a heck of
72 or more hours. Yeah.
Definitely. So Timothy Gaskell says, I haven't even decided which party's primary to vote in yet. I'd probably have a bigger influence on state politics helping choose Republican nominees, and a bigger influence on national politics, helping choose Democratic nominees. Interesting perspective there.
You know, I wonder how many Texas Republicans are going to actually go and vote in the Democratic primary.
Or,
I mean, it's possible. You can do it here.
Yeah,
in
open primary state.
Right.
And, of course, it goes both ways there, too. And with that sort of single-minded dominance of the Republican machinery in Texas in years past, I think we have seen many Democrats cross over and vote in those primaries. So last day to do it if you haven't done it already.
Of course, you can always vote on Super Tuesday. And by the way, we should mention we're going to be covering Super Tuesday quite in-depth on the day. So you may want to keep it here as you get to updates from across the U.S. on NPR, and of course we'll have our station statewide providing coverage as the tally comes in from across Texas. We're out of time for the big broadcast. We'll be back here Monday. Till then, I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar wishing you a wonderful weekend.
Thanks.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.